Welcome to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for September 19th, 2002. I'm Amy Brown, here with co-host Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we'll be talking with Eddie Yoon, one of the editors of The Battle of Seattle, the new challenge to capitalist globalization. But first, this news.
Nike held its annual shareholder meeting in Portland, Maine on Wednesday, September 18th, and was met with a broad coalition of Maine anti-sweatshop activists who held a protest and press conference in support of Indonesian Nike workers fighting for recognition of their legal right to organize to improve working conditions. 20 anti-sweatshop, peace, labor, and social justice groups signed onto a statement criticizing Nike and encouraging them to support workers' rights. Nike has shut down three main shoe manufacturing plants, Saco in 1985, Lewiston Cole Haan plant in 1996, and Livermore Falls Cole Haan plant in 1999, laying off hundreds of workers while shifting production to the overseas sweatshops. The story, activists said, is repeating itself in Indonesia, where Nike is planning to cut back orders just as workers are gaining increased political freedoms to form unions and minimum wages are increasing. In August 2002, Nike announced plans to end orders and eliminate nearly 7,000 jobs from PT Dawson, one of its most productive and also its most unionized contractor in Indonesia, and shift production to China or Vietnam, where worker organizing is repressed. Fearing a devastating impact on their community and families, PT Dawson workers are urging Nike to cancel plans for withdrawals, commit itself to a long-term relationship, and support the union's attempt to negotiate a collective bargaining contract. According to Rustam Aksam, president of the Indonesian Textile, Garment, and Leather Workers Union, quote, Nike has no social responsibility. They're just exploiting the workers, getting their profit, and then leaving, end quote. Maine activists pointed out Nike's behavior is not compatible with Maine standards of ethical production as expressed in last year's groundbreaking clean clothes legislation. Bjorn Skopern Klaesen of the Bangor Clean Clothes Campaign said, unless Nike honored Indonesian workers' demands to respect their legal rights and disclose names and locations of their factories, Nike would probably be ineligible for state contracts. Renewing its commitment to PT Dawson would be a step in the right direction, end quote. Radioactive will cover this story in more depth on next week's program.
Next Monday, September 23rd, the Maine People's Alliance, in coalition with Consumers for Affordable Healthcare, will be holding a conference at the Augusta Civic Center entitled Universal Healthcare in Maine, Time for Action. The highlight of the conference will be a panel of the gubernatorial candidates discussing the issue. The conference begins at 9 o'clock in the morning and ends at 4 in the afternoon. A single-payer universal healthcare rally at the Capitol Building will follow. For more information, contact the Maine People's Alliance at 990-0672.
As I watch a shadow man on TV lie to keep his job at his command, the streets are gassed until you couldn't breathe. The angry mob were mostly people sitting down in front of cops who carried water cannons, plastic bullets, shields, and masks, while folks carried on bought food and beer and mailboxes you could pull upon. A shirt of cloth that lets you breathe. The stores are open just like any other day. Hoses hung out on St. John from families that left them on for you to drink or wash. Somebody overcome by fumes could go inside the crowded bar with bottles of vinegar lined up to pour upon a shirt of cloth that lets you breathe like any other day, except the people loved each other just for being there. You should have seen the strangers kneel to help someone to throw themselves onto that ugly fence and clash with rocks and gas and water to tear it down and then just sit still in front of the open space, which quickly filled with riot cops who faced their population but would not look you in the eye. As the night wore on, the jails filled up. Cops dressed like protesters beat some up in air so thick you couldn't breathe. They bombed their toxins off the overpass, hitting people in the face. You can even be inside without that shit burning your eyes. You get so mad you want to puke. You hear they hit the medical center and you know this is depravity. Behind Behind the fence, they had to stop their talks from tear gas.
Next week, activists will converge in Washington, D.C. to challenge the World Bank and International Monetary Fund at its meeting on September 28th. This is part of a continuing wave of international protests that have become higher profile for their challenge to corporate globalization and the institutions and policies that consequently accelerate the gap between rich and poor, the degradation of the environment, and the shift of decision-making power away from governmental and non-governmental institutions and popular input. We have with us here today Eddie Yun, one of the editors of the recently published book, The Battle of Seattle, The Challenge to Capitalist Globalization, a conglomeration of various essays by writers and activists. This, the Soft Skull Press, says of the book: "The uprising against the World Trade Organization in November 1999 was the most visible and dramatic protest in the United States since the Vietnam War. From Washington, D.C. to the party conventions and on to Prague, Cancun, and Genoa, the new movement against capitalist globalization grew. The Battle of Seattle roots these events globally in an anti-capitalist history. The resistance to the IMF and the neoliberal project in Venezuela, Korea, and Chiapas, the mass organizing campaigns of the nuclear freeze movement in the 1980s, and the innovative direct action tactics of environmentalists in the U.S. In this volume, the street-level reporting covers the action while involved thinkers ask the questions on the collective mind of the movement. How can a movement that claims to be global root itself in local communities? What happens to nonviolent tactics in an environment of increasing ruthless policing? Can NGOs be agents of social transformation, or are they only a mirror of the dominant society within the movement? How can a predominantly white activist scene in the U.S. and Europe form respectful ties with activists of color? Does trashing Starbucks damage capitalism itself?" Essays from the front line and engaged analysis tackle all these questions. The Battle of Seattle ranges wider and cuts deeper than any other books published in the aftermath of November 1999 and invites readers to join the intensive debates within the anti-globalization movement and to make some history of their own. Howard Zenn says this about the book: "The Battle of Seattle recounts an important era in the history of people's struggles against international corporate domination of our lives. It has the immediacy of the on-street journalism and the perspective of thoughtful observers. I hope it will be widely circulated." Welcome, Eddie Yun.
Thank you.
I probably should add your biography. You are a PhD candidate in the sociology program at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and you teach or have taught recently at the Brooklyn College and City University of New York. And you join us today from New York. Why don't you jump off by telling us of how you got involved in working on this book and some of the thoughts you had behind that?
Well, it's funny. I mean, the book just came out of the movement, of course, and I, like so many other people, was inspired by the events of Seattle. But I've also been involved in this kind of thing, social protest, over the years, and realized that there was a real gap that needed to be filled in terms of people's understandings, both of where this movement came from within the U.S., the long traditions within the U.S., and also, perhaps even more importantly, the events of the last, say, 20 years within, especially the non-Western countries, we call it the Global South, right? And how those events all led up to Seattle. So that was the initial project, and of course it took off because we just got involved talking to so many activists, so many people, to try to really put together a collection which at least documents that moment in history. Now at the time when we did this, we thought, you know, this is an ongoing movement, it's accelerating, it's growing, which is still the case on the global level. But, of course, after 9/11 in the U.S. especially, this movement has been completely buried by the media, right? It's like it never happened. So I think it's important, the book sort of came out, you know, just this year, to reflect on the fact that this movement did exist and, in fact, does exist globally. And it's because of this movement that there's, you know, some hope, I think, in the world that we're not faced between a horrible struggle between imperial U.S., you know, which is the oligarchy, as we all know, on the one hand, and the kind of religious fascism on the other, right? There actually are other choices. We're not in a new Cold War. There's a whole other project alive in the world, and that people call the anti-globalization movement. We can talk about what that means, but...
Yes, and you want to talk a little bit about the international movement and how these connections are made with each other around the world. There seems to be sort of a relationship between the different movements, or it's between the different protests.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what's really fascinating, of course, is, you know, Seattle, look at this movement as a kind of, we could look at it as like a cyclone or a storm, and it's touched down in different places, and in 1999 it touched down in Seattle, And from there, it sort of shifted to Europe, Prague, Nice, and culminated in Genoa, which was a horrendous police riot, unbelievable brutality that occurred in Genoa. And now the focus has really shifted to Latin America, I would argue. That's where the movement is really strongest now. But what we did in the book is we traced it earlier. We took a look at what were the antecedents to Seattle. And, of course, you could really start with Columbus. Certainly, if you're talking about a project against a certain kind of globalization, which is imperialist in nature or unequal fundamentally. But we decided to just look at the last 20 years when the IMF and the World Bank, the two institutions that people will be protesting next week in Washington, D.C., when these institutions implemented the structural adjustment program policy, mm-hmm. Which was really, new terms for the old, the same old, same old. And it was basically taking away the gains which had been made by sovereign third world nations after decolonization. And in this period, from the late 70s, early 80s, you had just everywhere the IMF went with these programs, you had resistance. And we actually have a map in the book which shows all over the world. I mean, Latin America, Bolivia, Ecuador, Jamaica, Jordan, throughout the Philippines, South Korea, basically all over the world, there were these massive protests.
We should just define a little bit what the structural adjustment programs did and why people were opposed to them. Do you want to go ahead and just say a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I'm sorry. They basically, I think your most listeners probably know that the condition of the majority of the world's people and the world environment is deplorable, right? It's a massive global apartheid system where several thousand children die every hour of totally preventable malnutrition. What the structural adjustment programs were doing was to roll back the limited gains that had been made by governments, not socialist governments, not nationalist governments, not radical governments at all, but simply any kind of government that had dared to try to create any kind of programs that were oriented towards the well-being of the people and not of the multinational corporations. So what you had, a classic example would be forcing governments to denationalize their electricity, their water supply, their telecommunications, sell them off to the highest bidder, which would be multinational corporations. This would result in massive job loss and also a massive increase in the price of services. So a lot of these rebellions started off when fuel prices increased dramatically as a result of the structural adjustment. What that means, of course, is people have to pay more for transportation. It's not that people have cars, but they take a bus to go to work. All of a sudden, there's quadruples in a society where people don't have the money literally to pay for it. They have to choose between eating meals or taking the bus. And so this is what led to rebellions throughout the world. And there's specific examples. I mean, the most violent in terms of the repression by far was in Caracas, Venezuela, in 1989, in which over 600 people were killed by forces of the state, and that led in its own way directly to the advent of Chavez coming into power, which again, he's not a friend of the anti-globalization movement, but it represents a kind of nationalism that arises out of this massive dislocation that's caused. So that's, in a nutshell, what these programs are.
In a side note to relate to the early Nike story people were bringing up yesterday speaking there, talking about the World Bank trying to push through some policies through the Indonesian government that would actually roll back workers' rights in as a law in Indonesia, and the World Bank was purporting this to make it a better business climate. So things like that you're speaking about. So, but sorry, go on.
That's it. We could go. I mean, you look at the paper any day, and you'll find examples. The New York Times today has a story about how the world coffee prices have collapsed, which basically means that the millions of coffee farmers, that are small peasants, the people that are just making a living in the coffee, are in dire straits. And, of course, this is a cause for celebration by the multinationals that control the markets. So, I mean, even the New York Times now, they report this, and then they actually have to mention fair trade coffee. So that's a sign that the movement has made some gains and put fair trade coffee on the agenda. But if you look at any paper any day, even especially, I would say, a paper like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, you'll find stories about this, about what's happening, which is really, historically speaking, the further dislocation of tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people from around the world, from any kind of traditional life they might have had, towards these nightmarish third world cities or towards a perilous and often deadly immigration to the rich countries where they'll be criminalized and treated as slaves in some cases. And also, of course, the further degradation of the environment, which is the direct result of all this so-called free trade as well.
Right, and one of the things that I think really shocks people when they first learn about it is the privatization has spread so far as to even, as you mentioned earlier, privatization of water supply. So people can't afford clean drinking water. I mean, they can't afford anything close to clean drinking water. People are dying from diseases from water while there's water available, and they just can't afford it. It seems like the next thing to privatization of, like, the oxygen you breathe. I think that's really hard for people who are privileged to live in areas where that's not an issue yet to even conceive of not being able to get any form of clean water at all.
Yeah, this is a great example, because one of the most outstanding victories of this movement in recent years has been the rebellion in Bolivia by indigenous people against the privatization of the water, which was, of course, contracted in part by a multinational that we're all familiar with, Bechtel, which in fact is now suing
them.
Government through the WTO, the World Trade Organization, which is the very body which was the focal point of demonstrations in Seattle. So, again, yeah, it's a kind of a crackpot realism, or crackpot rationality, this economic model that everything should be privatized, everything can be privatized, because, I mean, I think, yeah, water, oxygen, these are examples of things that precisely should not be privatized. They're global commons. Maybe just say one more thing on this. It's in the book, but it's a famous memo that was written by Lawrence Summers, who was the Treasury Secretary and is now President of Harvard, who a memo was leaked from his office. When he was, prior to this, he was at the World Bank. He's had a revolving door career. And then in his position at the World Bank, he wrote a memo basically saying that Africa was severely underpolluted vis-a-vis the rest of the world because, there's no industry in Africa because Africa has been so completely pillaged, of course, through colonialism. But basically saying, well, in fact, we need to organize a system where the rich countries who don't want pollution anymore can dump their pollution in Africa.
Which is just formalizing what a lot of them have been doing informally all along anyway.
Exactly. And to this, a Brazilian minister, I can't remember the exact title, said, "Your logic is impeccably rational and thoroughly insane." And I think that this is, of course, precisely what we're up against on the global level, right? This is the logic of capitalism is ideology, right? Is an idea that everything can be organized in this way. This is... it's a theory that we're opposing, but of course it's also a practice, and they're related.
And in this light, how would you and those who, if you can characterize those who wrote in the book, how would you define the anti-globalization movement?
I think the best way, perhaps to put it into a slogan form, which we unfortunately have to do in these limited time frames that we have, but just to get anybody's attention, is to cite Subcomandante Marcos, a great man with words, who really, more than any other figure, any other movement, the Zapatistas in Mexico, really jump-started this thing in terms of naming it. And what he says, the slogan they put forward, maybe not him, but the movement, is one no, many yeses. And what this means is that globalization, when people talk about globalization, in the business press, they're really talking about capitalist globalization. They're talking about precisely the ideology we've just been describing, in which everything is for sale, in which anything else is irrational, and it goes against market forces, right? And a counterpost to that is not one dogmatic ideology. It's certainly not. It's precisely the idea that the world is extraordinarily diverse. Biodiverse diversity, cultural diversity, linguistic diversity, all of these things are ground into one homogenous unit of exploitable value, and this is, this is the logic we've been asked to take up. And so the opposition, the strength of the opposition, but also the sort of the difficult project of naming the opposition, is that it is going to be extremely diverse, so that indigenous people in Bolivia are going to operate under their own, literally their own language, but also their own understanding of what it is. And this is what, to some extent, I guess, differentiates this movement from some previous social movements that have felt the need to create, the 10-point platform and everybody sign up and this sort of thing. At the same time, the movement is united with opposition, the fact that people are increasingly articulate about what it is they're opposing. That is, people used to always say, well, we're against corporate globalization. I think there's an increasing awareness that, capitalism itself needs to be named. I mean, corporations are a form that capital takes, but, you know, capital can take other forms. So there's a real increasing awareness that people need to name this, and by naming it, you do create a kind of unity. But also, there's still this strong localist tendency, I think, really characterizes this movement. And I guess the one other thing I would say, anti-globalization is not a satisfactory term, if for no other reason than, in fact, this movement against it is extremely global, right? It's extraordinarily global. It's networked. It's creative. It's constantly learning. That is, people learn. One thing we followed in this movement is that people learn different things from other movements around the world. So the United States, which most people remember in Europe, especially wrote off as the land of Bush and Reagan and conformity, people across Europe were so impressed with Seattle, and one thing they learned from it was how to organize non-hierarchically along feminist process principles. You know, that's one part of the movement that's done better in the U.S. than in many places in Europe, where you still have kind of the male charismatic leader types. You know, this is a model that's been learned from the U.S. Similarly, of course, the Zapatistas spread a model of organizing of the Encuentro, which came from indigenous communities. From the Italian movement, people have learned various new kinds of tactics that are trying to break through this impasse of militancy versus pacifism, right? So there's all sorts of things that are learning, and so the movement is a kind of a global Skillshare session, if you like, mm-hmm. and it is in fact a form of internationalism. And what we're trying to do here is in the map that we do in the book is to show, in fact, that the movement has been going on for a lot longer than is properly credited. It didn't start in Seattle, and so in fact, there is without being so named, there is a kind of a new international. Right, but one that won't fall into the pitfalls of previous internationals having to do with hierarchies and, you know, domination of the core over the periphery and so on. So that's I'm not sure what we want to call it. I'm open to suggestions. But I think a more important thing is we know by its content what it is we're talking about.
Great. Did you have a question? We're going to have to wrap up the next couple of minutes, so maybe I just put it out to you if there are some particular points that you would like to make about this so-called movement or about the book and where you're going from here.
Well, and how people can get a hold of the book or find out more.
Yeah, the book should be available. It was sold out, and it's back available again. www.softskull.com would be the website. And you should ask, whatever, if you're interested, local bookstores to carry it. But, of course, this book is just one project among many. There's so many things coming on. Your show is an important part of that, just getting information out, because, the media is a whole other question, one of the most important things. I would just like to say the last word on it today would be that that this movement, even if the media ignores it, it does still exist. It may not be peaking here anymore, as it was in Seattle, but it's peaking in Argentina, right, and in Bolivia, and in Ecuador, where next month there will be the huge Free Trade of the Americas conference, there will be massive demonstrations.
Where will that be, though?
In Quito, Ecuador, the FTAA. And, of course, in Johannesburg a few weeks ago, we saw very clear expressions from the people there of basically this movement. They're saying exactly the same things, and they say we see ourselves as part of a movement from Seattle to Genoa. So let's not despair over the seeming new world order in which we're torn between having to support, patriotism means supporting a state which wants a permanent warfare against a totally hideous fundamentalism, right, on the opposite side of whatever kind it is, right? There are more choices than that on offer. And the important thing about this movement is that it creates space for a necessary expression of something which is different, something which is democratic, tolerant of diversity, respectful of human rights, anti-militarist, anti-violent. This is what's needed right now. And so whatever you feel you can do your part, whether it's going to Washington or just writing something or talking to people, I think it's all part of it at this stage.
Great. Thank you so much, Eddie Yun, for joining us. Eddie Yun was one of the editors of the book, The Battle of Seattle, The New Challenge to Capitalist Globalization. And again, would that be correct to say the website would be softskull.com?
Yeah, that's correct.
Great.
Thank you so much.
And Amy has one more announcement. Thank you, Eddie.
Right. If people are thinking about going to D.C. next week for the protests against the IMF and World Bank and you're looking for more information, you can go to www.dc.indymedia.org or globalizethis.org. There are plans for teach-ins all week. Next Friday, a week from tomorrow, there'll be a people's strike organized by the Anti-Capitalist Convergence. On Saturday, there are plans to quarantine the attendees of the World Bank IMF conference. And in the week leading up to it, there are many different workshops and protests and vigils organized. So that's www.dc.indymedia.org for more information on that.
While we were in Bonn, basically having a big party, there were a lot of stuff was going on in Genoa, and part of a series, and interrupted recently by a cataclysmic event, but this is a song about shutting down the various financial institutions of the world, and it's sort of generic, vague kind of thing. You know, it can apply to whichever one you care to shut down. And it has a four-word chorus, and I hope you'll all join me with it.
We shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight them on the shore. They will bring us exploitation. We'll bring them their class war. And we'll lock down to the gates as they're spreading vicious lies. They want to dominate the world, and we see through their disguise. If they'd have one big multinational with their corporate flag unfurled, searching everywhere for the lowest wages in the world, then we'll have one big union from Melbourne to Prague to Seattle town. Wherever they may go, we will shut them down, we'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down.
Got the chorus yet? That's it. That's.
And CNN will spread the lies. This is just how it's gotta be. Well, they can have their CNN, 'cause we've got our IMC. And we'll tell the truth quite clearly, though they don't wanna hear it. And they'll try to stop our broadcasts, 'cause the truth is that they fear it. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. They'd have a world full of strip malls, plants grown by biotech. As long as they get richer, they just don't give a heck. But we don't want their ecocide. We want a world we can live in. That's why we're here to stay. And we're not gonna give in. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down.
Sounding good.
And they will infiltrate us, provocateurs within our ranks. And if they can't divide us, they'll send the planes and tanks. But we will stand together, pacifists and Zapatistas, workers, farmers, the indigenous, tree huggers and baristas. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. What are we gonna do? We will shut them down. And we will build a new world without the corporate elite. And we will see the day of their international defeat. We'll have self-determination and equality for all. For what choice do we really have but to rise up and see them fall? We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down.
One more time.
We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down.
That's Dave Rovics with Shut Them Down.
You've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. I'm Meredith DeFrancesco.
And I'm Amy Brown. We'd like to thank Joel Mann for engineering today, Andy Buckley for web support, Rich Bully and Bjorn Claussen for production assistance, and you for listening and acting.
You can contact us here at WERU or by emailing radioactivenews@hotmail.com.
You can listen to archived radioactive programs on the web at www.freespeech.org/RAN or at mainindymedia.org.
Please join us again next Thursday and stay tuned now for Free Speech Radio News, then Democracy Now!